Hello, everybody. Welcome. Very large room. We'll begin. I invite everybody, as it's such a large room, to come to the center. I know we have some country plates, but anyway. Just to let you know, interpretation is available if it's required. It's my pleasure to introduce Special Representative Mitri, who will be giving a briefing. And we'll have time for a few questions, hopefully quite a few questions, at the end. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm pleased to be with you this morning, and I don't think I need to repeat myself. I made my briefing yesterday to the Security Council, and the full text is available for you to read, so I won't repeat it or sum it up. I will highlight what I thought made this briefing different from the previous ones. Just that you and I don't get bored. Of course, I had to say something about the security situation, because this is the worry of many, and often I'm asked questions, detailed questions about the security situation. It receives good coverage in the media. It is volatile, no doubt, but I can say with a measure of confidence that the security situation is not as alarming as it is sometimes depicted in the media. I mean, it's true there are 200,000, maybe more, Libyans that are armed. It is true that there is proliferation of weapons in Libya. Some give the figure of 3 million arms of all sorts in the hands of a population of 6 million. Forget about the figures. These are estimates that no one is able to verify. But against such estimations, one would expect Libya to be a jungle. And Libya is not a jungle. There are security incidents, mostly in the east, but elsewhere as well. But some are very tragic. But the situation is not alarming as it is sometimes portrayed. Yesterday, one permanent representative asked me how normal life is in Tripoli. And my answer was, yes, life in Tripoli is normal. Perhaps if you move around after 10 p.m., then you might be stopped by armed men. Your car might be carjacked. But during the day, nothing happens. People get on with their lives and their work. So it's not as dramatic as it is portrayed, but it is serious and volatile, and anything can happen anytime, and we're all worried about the security situation. The second point I thought I needed to make more emphatically than on previous occasions is that the relationship between the revolutionary brigades and the state are still an object of strong polarization. Differences are still unresolved. Uh, Recently, the General National Congress has voted Resolution 53, asking the government to work out a plan of disarming the brigades and integrating its members into legitimate state security and military institutions. But it will be some time before this resolution can be fully implemented. And the problem is that the revolutionaries do not see themselves, as they are seen by others, as obstacles on the way of democratic transition. Revolutionary brigade members see themselves as political actors. And short of engaging them in the political process, no disarming, no reintegration in the state, military, and security institutions is possible. Many of those revolutionaries have developed a sense of having been excluded from the political process. They tell us, while there were elections in Libya, July 2012, we were busy making the revolution. The revolution was not over. And therefore, we did not take part in the elections. We didn't run for elections. We're not well represented in the General National Congress. It seems to me that if they hold on to their arms, it's not just simply because they love carrying weapons, but because they think that having arms gives them a leverage to negotiate their share in the power structure of the country. And one has to recognize this reality and has to engage them in the political process. This is why I had offered my good offices, and I've been meeting with representatives of revolutionary brigades in the last 2 months, listening to them, trying to understand their deep motivations and what is their perspective on the future of the state building in Libya, and interpret what they have to say to the government, who had not been, for obvious reasons, in regular dialogue, as it were, with them. A third issue I had mentioned in my briefing, which I had not been mentioned before, was the plight of the internally displaced people in Libya. And I referred more particularly to a community, the Tawarghans, people who were inhabitants of a little town near Misrata in western to central Libya. This town, it is believed that many of its young male population were drafted by Gaddafi and fought with Gaddafi's brigades against the revolution. And then during the revolution, there were massacres in the neighboring city of Misrata attributed to people from Tawarga. There were cases of rape, of house demolitions, and therefore the people of Misrata were able to expel them from their hometown and put fire into their houses. And now these people live in refugee camps in Tripoli, Benghazi, and elsewhere. And they have announced that they are planning to return on June 26. And they come to us at the United Nations. They said, you have a mandate to protect the civilian population. We are civilians. We want to go home. You've got to protect us. Much of what we've been doing recently was to convince them that while we affirm their right to return to their homes, it's the right of every citizen to return to his or her home, we consider that returning on the 26th of June is fraught with risks. And the people of Misrata would not allow this to happen, and the government is not in a position to protect them as they return. So we invite them to be more patient, but at the same time try to create better conditions for those for their return. One of the conditions is the creation of a fact-finding commission, because people talk about massacres, rapes, and what have you, but no proper investigation has ever been initiated. So the truth of what has happened 2 years ago is still, the full truth is not known. So one of the conditions is to have a truth commission. Another condition is to have a government protection, which is not made available at this point. And the third is to initiate dialogue between the Tawargans and their neighbors in Misrata. And this is the most difficult task. They're not ready on both sides, for probably more on Misratan side, but on both sides they're not ready for that dialogue. I think in general, there are groups armed and unarmed that are not ready for dialogue towards reconciliation. I've heard many people tell us it's premature to talk about reconciliation. It's the time to talk about justice, not about reconciliation. And unless there is transitional justice that redresses part of the wrongs that were done to segments of the Libyan population, you cannot initiate a reconciliation process. So this is something that needs to be taken fully in account. We shall continue to advocate reconciliation, uphold the values of healing memories and let the past be the past and look forward to the future. We will continue in our speech to uphold those values, knowing well enough that the Libyan society is not ready yet for reconciliation. And what indicated to us how unready we are was the polarization in Libya on a law called the Law on Political Isolation, better called the Law on Political Exclusion, that has poisoned political life for the last few months and was approved by the General National Congress. It's a law that is far-reaching, that prevents a large number of people who have served Gaddafi's regime or the state under Gaddafi, who will be, according to the law, prevented from holding public office or exercising any political role. They are excluded, according to this law, by those who would like to see new Libya purged from those who had collaborated with the previous dictatorial regime. Something similar to what happened in Iraq with the de-Ba'athification law, I'm sure some of you are aware of it. This has divided the country and therefore makes, again, reconciliation more difficult. Needs a little more time before we can think of initiatives that would make reconciliation possible. In my briefing, I also referred somewhat with a measure with a measure of criticism to all of us involved in international assistance to Libya. I mean, there is a lot of international technical assistance that is offered to the Libyans, and the United Nations has the role of coordinating this assistance. There is a lot that is being offered, but my sense, and I said that candidly to the Security Council yesterday, is that this assistance spreads very thin. There are, it's a piecemeal assistance. There are lots of things being offered, but they are bits and pieces. And the needs of Libya are huge, and they are immediate. And some of what is offered to Libya is not a priority for the Libyans. And what is offered to the Libyans according to their own priority seems to be insufficient. So how to match the immediate, urgent needs of the Libyans with what is offered by way of assistance remains to all of us a challenge. We've had a conference, a ministerial conference in Paris in February, which tried to do the exercise of matching needs with proposed assistance. And we are trying to make sure what has been agreed upon in Paris is fully implemented. But the implementation has been very slow, precisely because the priorities agreed upon in Paris were too many. And it is perhaps time to agree on priorities within those priorities. And this is something I alluded to in my presentation yesterday. I also spoke for the first time about how the UN is perceived in Libya. When I joined the United Nations as a special representative of the Secretary General, the UN was universally welcome in Libya. I was told this was the case, and that was the impression I had when I arrived in Tripoli. Now, I think large numbers of Libyans continue to welcome the UN. And there is a good memory of UN's involvement with and in Libya. You know that the United Nations had somehow midwifed the birth of independent Libya in 1951. And most Libyans remember that with gratitude. Most Libyans remember with gratitude resolutions 1917, 1973 that made possible the military intervention meant to protect the civilian population. Of course, an intervention that went a little beyond protecting, or not so little, beyond protecting the civilian population. But Libyans remember that with a measure of gratitude. But having said this, there are two groups of Libyans now. They're probably minorities, but they speak with a loud voice, those two minorities. There are those who are suspicious of the international community's design in regard to Libya's future. They accuse the UN of paving the way for a more interventionist policy in Libya at the expense of Libya's national sovereignty. While we maintain and we truly believe that our role as the United Nations is to help the Libyans fulfill their own priorities and that we should not interfere in any way in domestic political affairs, there are those who suspect that the international community might want to exercise hegemony over Libya. They are a minority, but a minority that speaks loud, a vociferous minority, if I may. But there is also another minority at the other extreme of the political spectrum who would like to see the UN presence become a little more robust, that the UN is basically a group of experts helping various Libyan state institutions reconstruct themselves. That was good, but that is insufficient in their eyes. They would like us to have more means and ways of giving them support beyond advice and technical assistance. But the majority in between those two extremities, the majority of Libyans continue to be supportive, but they know very little about the UN. Therefore, we have a sort of educational role and a role with the media. I'm told that the other UN missions are not used to engage the media the way we're trying to do that in Libya. I feel it is we have an obligation to speak, explain, deny, refutate, correct, redress, and this is taking much of my own time, but I think this is essential. Finally, I emphasized in my briefing the importance of initiating national political dialogue. There are political institutions that are functioning. There is a General National Congress that meets, legislates, takes decisions. There is a functioning government that meets, takes decisions, allocate budgets. So political institutions function, but there need to be a space for political dialogue that would involve not just the elected members of the General National Congress, but all other political actors, the revolutionaries, tribal leaders, civil society, should be involved in the political process, and we need to create a space where national political dialogue is possible. And the UN is committed to help creating this space. I said help, for it's not for the UN to do what the Libyans should be doing, but the UN is there to help the Libyans do what they need to do. That is, in a period of transition, make sure that no one in Libya is excluded from the political process. And this is tied in with the constitution-making process. Libya is about to, the General National Congress in Libya is about to vote an electoral law that would make possible the elections of a 60-member constitution-drafting assembly. If such a law is approved, then the elections would take place within 6 months, say the end of this year or early next year. We will have a 60-member drafting assembly that would work on the constitution. It is likely that in May 2014, Libya will have a constitution, and then we would be able to have national elections. For the General National Congress that was elected in July of last year is provisional. For the government that is in place calls itself a provisional government of Libya. It's only after the general election that there will be a sense of permanence of the political institutions of the country. I mean, I cannot make predictions about timeline, but I think we would need a little more than a year before this is made possible. Now, constitution is important not only as a document drafted by a 60 members assembly. The constitution is the mirror of a new social contract that binds Libyans together. And therefore, it's not the affair of 60 men and women sitting in a room and drafting. It's everybody's affair. And the United Nations is committed to offer its assistance in organizing the widest possible debate on constitutional issues, including the controversial ones, so that the work of the Constitution Drafting Assembly would reflect what may emerge as a consensus within Libyan society. Not only a consensus within Libya's political class, but within the whole of society. This is what makes constitutions living documents, not just legal documents you approve in through a referendum. What is called Libya's transition to democracy or democratic transition, whatever is more familiar to you, an expression, depends on this process of agreeing on a constitution. And no matter what happens in terms of security, no matter what the problems are, we should not lose sight of the centrality of the constitutional process. It is by far the most important process in Libyan public life in the next year. And I felt I needed to emphasize this in my briefing to the Security Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Sir, we have time for questions. I think it's easier if we take them in groups of three, perhaps. And just before you start speaking, if you could just introduce yourself, please. Thank you. I think we'll start with our friend from Italy. Yeah.
Merci. Thank you. I'm Michael Thomas, political coordinator from Italy's mission to the UN. Sir Minister, it's true, we've heard several times now from you over the recent days, but it's always very interesting and stimulating. And on each occasion, we learn something new. So thank you for your patience and your perseverance. You've described to us a difficult transitional phase with security challenges. You've talked to us about an unstable but not dramatic situation. You described a country with political institutions that exist and are working. Therefore, I believe that we need to be aware of the challenges in Libya, but at the same time, we need to look at the positive aspects, which are encouraging, and we need to persevere in our support for the stabilization of the country. And with our support to UNSMIL, which plays a fundamental role, also thanks to, how can I say, your leadership, we're aware of the fact that it is, after all, the Libyans themselves that their future belongs to, but we are supporting them. I'd like to mention paragraph 88 of the latest resolution, which is an important commitment of the international community. I won't hide that Italy is working hard here on that paragraph, and we have contributed that to that paragraph in question. I would like to conclude by saying that we've called for increased international support for Libya, which is consistent with our commitment over time and our current commitment. We have cooperative programs with around 56 million euro in almost all sectors. We've also taken note of the fact that international assistance sometimes lacks coherence and doesn't always meet the needs of Libya. We've also relayed that message to Rome. From this point of view, I think we can still make progress. Thank you, therefore, Mr. Minister, for your commitment. Thank you for your efforts for the future of Libya.
My name is Anna. I'm from the Portuguese Mission. I want to thank the Special Representative for always finding the time to speak with the non-council members when he's in New York. We very much appreciate that, especially because, as my colleague, Italian colleague, has said, your briefings are always extremely interesting, and we always take a lot from them. I had prepared two questions, but after your very thought-provoking briefing, I now have a few more. I will try to structure them so that we don't get lost and have a discussion that goes all over the place. They basically have to do with three things. One is with one issue is the isolation law / issue of transitional justice and reconciliation. The other has to do with the difficulties we still face in the security sector. And then my third question has to do with the issue of how the UN is being perceived in Libya in more recent times. As for the first issue, it's not clear to me yet what kind of support this isolation law actually has. It wasn't clear to me if this was an issue that was just hijacked by a loud minority, as you mentioned, and namely by a group of militias that saw that as a way of having some influence over a political process from which they feel excluded, or if the support for this goes much beyond that. Because it is important to understand that, because behind that you would understand how divisive the situation is in Libya, indeed. My other question related to this is, I know that the implementation of the law has been postponed, if I'm not mistaken, but what do you expect the short-term implications of this law to be? And are there any ways of between now and then, or maybe through the constitutional process, of finding ways of mitigating the more negative consequences that this law could have on the transitional process, but also in efforts around national reconciliation and so forth? Then on the security, you have more or less answered part of my question. Namely in the fact that maybe the response or the assistance the international community has given so far is not as tailored as it should be to the needs. But my question also is, what is the local capacity to absorb the assistance that is being provided or should be provided and is not being provided? Then on the perception of the UN, you mentioned there were two groups, very diametral positions vis-a-vis the UN. And my question has to do with the minority you said that is concerned that the UN is having a more interventionist role than they would desire. Is this group a unified and coherent group, or does it bring together different factions of society? Are these concerns mainly one of exacerbated sensitivity in view of a recently new acquired sense of national pride and ownership? Or is there also a concern that the UN, that the reform process and the standards that the UN is advocating and the international community is advocating is something that some minorities in Libya might not feel comfortable with? And I think I've given you enough to talk about. Thank you.
Well, merci, cher ami, donc pour ce que.
Thank you, dear friends, for all that Italy is doing and that our mission is receiving from your dear country. I think the Libyans are grateful for all Italy is doing. I also always tell my Italian friends that I'm very impressed by the capacity of the Italians and the Libyans, that they've lost their colonial memory, their ability to do that. Libyans are very hospitable people with respect to the Italians. It's a country that they can go to either for studies, for treatment, or business. the Libyans find Italy very generous in that respect. So it's no surprise for Italy to be so engaged with many kinds of support being provided by it.
Web of questions. The political isolation law, political exclusion law, has definitely some popular support in Libya. It's very difficult to gauge how wide is the support, but it definitely has support. But the adoption of the law has happened at a time where some revolutionary brigade has exerted undue pressure. They had besieged ministries. They had intimidated individual members of the General National Congress. They had, even at one point, they had shot at the car of the president of the General National Congress. So there were a series of incidents that preceded the adoption by the General National Congress of this law. So one could say that without this pressure, the law may not have been adopted, at least not the way it is now. But the law is the law. Dura lex, sed lex. It's a terrible law, I think, but it's a law, and it has to be implemented, and it will be implemented. I think there is some delay in its implementation because there will be a commission that will have to oversee the implementation, and members of this commission have to be vetted. And the vetting has not yet happened. So this is why we had a delay of 1 month before the law is implemented. Now, of course, like any law, it could be implemented in a way that would reduce to the greatest possible extent its consequences on Libya's public service. But it could also be implemented in a way that would enlarge the number of people that would be affected by it, because the law excludes people on the basis of both their affiliation and their conduct. And the criteria that are in this law are sometimes vague, therefore subject to interpretation, over-interpretation, misinterpretation, and they are far-reaching. The most ironic, tragic, the tragic irony is that the law would have affected President Almagariev, the president of the General National Congress, because once upon a time, he was ambassador to India in the early 80s. Now, Almagariev is an icon of opposition to Gaddafi. There were many attempts against his life. He has lived most of his adult life as a leader of the opposition. He was elected as a member of the General National Congress and president of the General National Congress, yet he would be excluded because of the letter of this law. There were attempts to have exemptions for those who have contributed to the revolution, but the General National Congress did not agree to granting exemptions. And President Almagariev had, in a dignified manner, had to resign before he will be destituted. Now, this is a tragic irony, as I call it. And yesterday at the Security Council, I felt I needed to pay tribute to this great man. I did. for all the things he's done for Libya, but also for the dignified way in which he withdrew from Libyan political life. We shall all look forward to see his books. You know, President Al-Magarif is a historian, and he's writing a 6 volumes book on the modern history of Libya. And most of us would are looking forward to seeing the 6th volume, where he would tell us the story of the last 2 years. You are absolutely right in referring to the... I'll come back again to this political isolation, but you're absolutely right in saying that there are limited local capacities in Libya, institutional capacities, to absorb much of the technical assistance that is offered. And this makes the situation paradoxical. I mean, there are Libyans who want more, but they're not able to absorb what is less. And you need to absorb the less to ask for more. That is, that seems to make sense. But I'm one of those who think that in certain areas, like border security, if I may take an example, and I speak under your authority, I think Libyans need a little more than what is offered to them. They need border security. They are offered border advice on border management. Advice on border management is only a tiny bit of what the Libyans need by way of border security. Yesterday, I spoke to the Security Council. I said, what can we do? I said, border security in Libya is not a Libyan issue only. It's an issue for the whole region. The president of Niger accused Libya of having porous borders. He forgot when he was referring to fighters, radical Islamist fighters from Mali coming to Libya. That's what he says. That's what he claims. Now, he forgot to say that these people crossed the borders of Niger twice had they come to Libya, that the borders of Niger are more porous than the borders of Libya. And if the borders between Niger and Libya are porous, they are porous on both sides. And so is the case with Chad. And therefore, you cannot solve Libya's borders problem with the Libyans alone. And the international community can play a role in making sure that the regional dimension of border security is properly dealt with. So that is one example. Now, I wanted to come back, and sorry for having missed that, about measures of mitigating the effects of such a law, political isolation law. I've heard people say, but I will not take credit for that, myself, I've heard people say that perhaps in the Constitution there could be an article that practically would abrogate the political isolation law. It is I'm not drafting that article. But you could, if the Constitution says all Libyans are equal in their civil and political rights and can access any public office, except if they are subject of criminal investigation in view of their human rights violation or corruption under Gaddafi, then if you have an article like this in the Constitution, then the political isolation law becomes unconstitutional, therefore inapplicable. So that might be a way of mitigating the effects of the law. But the Constitution is for next year. Now, what will happen during this year remains to be seen. Those who speak about the UN in a negative hue are a small minority, but vociferous, as I said. And you know, there is a fantastic thing in Libya that's about freedom also. The number of television outlets, radios, newspapers, social media, websites is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like this. And then people sometimes can be credulous because they're not used to enjoy so much freedom of speech. And then suffice it to write a statement on your Facebook page, and then another Facebook page quotes you, and then the word is spread, you know, all over Libya. And much of what was said about the United Nations was on Facebook pages primarily. It's hard to pinpoint who is orchestrating of all of this, if it is at all orchestrated. But I myself, in my numerous meetings with Revolutionary Brigade leaders, I'd heard some of them express their worries, asking me, what does it mean for Libya to be under Chapter 7? Well, I explained to them that Chapter 7 is for it's in Libya's favor. It's about the sanctions, and the sanctions are there because Libya wants the sanctions in order to be able to freeze the asset until it is in a better position to recover its assets. That's the explanation we gave, but still, the Chapter 7 is not music to many ears. In their view, it implicitly hints at the possibility of an intervention. I've seen revolutionaries tell me that the work we're doing in human rights is interventionist, because they accuse us of drawing lists of perpetrators of human rights violations. They don't know what are we going to make of these lists, but they say when Gaddafi was violating human rights, and God knows how much he did violate human rights, the international community was on the whole silent. Human Rights Watch has issued 20 statements on human rights violation in post-Gaddafi Libya, and has spoken only once about human rights violation in Gaddafi's Libya. So these people see this and therefore question our involvement in human rights. And I think that there is a hidden agenda. I've heard people say, oh, are you going to provide the International Criminal Court with lists of Libyan revolutionaries that are accused of human rights violation? Are you going to give our names to the Interpol so that we cannot travel? And I tried to say that my answer was no. We are upholding human rights because you, Libyans, who fought Gaddafi, have human rights values at the core of the objectives of your revolution. It is because human rights, the promotion of human rights, is a Libyan priority that we are involved in human rights. It's not a weapon in our hands to punish you. It's more in your support that much of what we're doing. And it is because we don't want the victims of human rights abuses in the past to become perpetrators. We don't want victims to mime their oppressors that we're doing what we're doing. So, but that is one reason why some of them are suspicious.
So,
Please, Svein. I think this will be the last round, so.
Sí, muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the SRSG for this opportunity you've given us once again to be briefed by you and to be updated by you on what is happening in Libya. Of course, this is a very useful exercise to have among politicians. It's very good for you to come to New York and to speak to the Security Council and to bring us together as well to share the information with us and to tell us what you're experiencing in Libya during this certainly complicated and difficult transitional process, which has good and bad aspects like any traditional process. But since the last time you were here, a scene from the outside, from our vantage point, of course, we were concerned with the security developments in recent months. And certainly that was reflected in reality on the ground. We saw a worsening of the security situation in the past several months in Libya in general, in Benghazi in particular, and of course that's a source of concern. So that leads to my first question. The process is continuing. We're in a pre-constitutional phase, as you have said, and we hope that there will be elections in December and that there will be a constitutional process at that time during that transitional phase, and the possibility for violence may be great. How can we improve upon this? How can we improve the situation and minimize violence? How can you control that situation to make sure that violence does not derail the process? I ask that question because, as you have said, there is a real threat for violence. So that's my first question. Secondly, on international assistance, you've said that there's a piecemeal approach, to use the English terminology, and that that's not sufficient. There's not a very well-coordinated approach. There is this piecemeal approach. So my question is, we've had the February meeting in Paris and other meetings at the international level to try to make international assistance as effective as possible. So my question is, what else can be done? What can we do to make sure that this assistance will be efficient and will not fall short and will not be piecemeal? And then in your second answer to the questions which my friend and colleague Anna from Portugal raised, you spoke about border security. And I'd like to insist on that point. It's a matter of concern not just for Libya, but for the countries of the region as well. And we know that, of course, the European Union has had a role to play. And it seems that that's been insufficient. Of course, you need to control the borders of a country such as Libya, and we recognize that it's a massive undertaking. It's complicated and difficult because of the length of the border, but also because of the geographic conditions. So I'd like to ask you if the efforts, the assistance and advice efforts, have fallen short, is there something more that can be done? And in your view, are we facing a situation which is improving slightly as compared to previous months? Is there any progress at all or not? And finally, I would just like to focus a little more on the issue of transitional justice and reconciliation. You've told us, and of course, it sounds quite reasonable for there to be reconciliation is the final stage when there's been a conflict, because there cannot be reconciliation without justice. Reconciliation needs to be a precondition, a prerequisite among the fighting groups. And so it's important to have that justice throughout system. You said that the former president of the National Assembly may be stepping down, may be stepping out of the picture. And of course, when you tell us such things, we regret hearing some of the elements of the things that you've told us of people who will no longer be involved. But again, coming back to reconciliation and national justice, how do you see things in the short term, and what can be done to move forward to improve future prospects and reconciliation among Libyans? Thank you.
So I think that's it, and sorry, Mr. Mitri, but you have about 2 minutes, two, 3 minutes to answer these complicated questions.
Most of the Libyans reject violence, and they have expressed that in so many ways. And I think the political leadership can capitalize on this popular demand for rule of law and against violence. I think the solution to the problem of violence is not only technical, it is political. And when I referred to the need to engage in everybody in the political process, I was suggesting that this is a way, too, of combating insecurity in Libya. That is as brief as I can be. It's not a technical issue, it's a political one. The problem of international assistance, if I may use the word problem, it may not be proper, is not coordination. We're doing enough coordination. It's the fact that there are too many priorities that are listed by the Libyans themselves. They're not invented by the international community. But the list is very long. And when the list is long, obviously what you're able to offer to cover all the territory that is in the list is limited. And I think we're discussing this in Tripoli with representatives, with your ambassadors, the possibility of looking again at this priority list and agree on priorities within the priorities. Like have 6 or 7 priorities out of 40 plus, and concentrate our efforts on those priorities in the next period. So that is one way of dealing with this problem. Border security is about border management. It is about engaging local communities that live on the borders. It's about equipment, and it's about regional concertation. There are at least 4 components to border security. Now, European Union is doing a very good job in offering advice on border management. That's very good. But then, what about equipment? What about engaging local communities? And what about making sure that this issue is dealt with as a regional issue? These are the tasks that lie ahead of us when it comes to border security. Now, when I referred to justice and reconciliation, I was descriptive and not prescriptive. I was describing what the mood in Libya is like. The mood is, let's have justice, and then we can talk about reconciliation. There are people who would especially
Libyans abroad, those who live in Egypt, in Tunisia, and who cannot go back to their homes, they highlight the urgency of reconciliation. But many of those who are in Tripoli, especially Revolutionary Brigade people, they're not in a hurry. They want to see justice implemented before we enter into a reconciliation mode. And there is some movement with respect to transitional justice. There is a draft law that we had helped preparing, and helped the Minister of Justice prepare, which has been tabled at the General National Congress, and we hope that it is approved. I think if it is approved, we will have, there will be a legal instrument that would set in motion a process of transitional justice. That will not in itself solve the problem, because legal instruments are not enough. You need to have people that can make use of those legal instruments. You have to have judges that are trained and immune from intimidation and fear. And that is not the case now. So there is, I think, a long way. Even if transition justice law is approved, there is a long way before the judiciary in Libya is able to implement such a law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This concludes the briefing. Thank you.